This is Doug Clark Jr. podcasting from Louisville, Kentucky, recording episode 2 of Working Class Park on November 17th, 2018. Welcome to the second episode of Working Class Park, where the news is for us, the workers. Thank you for listening to the episode, and let me begin by describing to you what this podcast is and why I created it. This podcast is for sparking the working class. What does that mean? It means that this podcast should serve as an ignition for workers kept down by the rich. It serves as a spark for street politics and collective action. And through these methods, we must fight for our freedoms and rights as human beings. This podcast is a rallying cry for you, the worker, the worker's advocate, and the desperately unemployed to stand up to the rich because workers have been screwed by the system. This is what this podcast is all about. Now, I know I've already gone over this in episode 1, but I want to go ahead and share some goals with you as a request that I would like to share with anybody who's listening for the first time. I would like to respond to some of your emails and share them with our fellow listeners if you want to send those in. I'll even give a shout out to anyone who sends in an email. And if you have the Anchor app on your iPhone or Android, you can actually leave a voice message for me here, so I would be able to play your actual voice message on the next podcast. I would also like to put together a segment with interviews, not every episode, but as they come, the opportunities come up, I could interview leaders, professionals, lecturers, and fellow workers who fight for the freedom of the working class. I'd be interested in interviewing some of you, the listeners, who have something to say that I think would fit the podcast purpose. And I would like to end each episode with a question for you to respond to so we could take the pulse of the working class and their advocates. You could then send in emails with your answers and ideas. So if you haven't gotten a sense of what is needed more than anything here to produce a worthy podcast, let me tell you, I need you to contribute. I need you to send me clippings of articles that you think would lend to the working class movement. I need referrals for people I could interview for the show. I need your book reviews and recommendations. I need to know the best working class freedom movement sites on the web. I need to be made aware of what is going on in your community towards helping the working class battle the parasitic rich. I need you to email what your thinking or opinions are regarding the show and the struggle. I need you to tell me, in general, what you, the listener, want out of this podcast. For this podcast to work, I need this to be a collective project amongst us listening, working class members, advocates, and the unemployed workers among us. So as for content in this episode, I'd like to go over a concept that I think is really important to the working class movement. And I know a lot of people have heard about it, but they might not know the specifics. They might think, oh, I've heard that word before, but what does it exactly mean? And it's called gentrification. And the verb is gentrify. That's a gentrified neighborhood. From a Britannica academic, the exact definition is the process of renewal and rebuilding accompanied by a wave of middle or upper class people moving into the area and displacing poor residents. Now, when they say middle class, they do not mean working class. They mean yuppies, trendy hipsters who want to come in and build their fancy coffee shops, put in their fancy restaurants and bars, buy a local grocery and turn it into a Whole Foods where it's unaffordable to the locals, and build huge lofts or some other kind of apartment building and run the original residents out of there through higher property taxes that they can no longer afford. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention define the real estate concept of gentrification as the transformation of neighborhoods from low value to high value. This change has the potential to cause displacement of long-time residents and businesses. When long-time or original neighborhood residents move from a gentrified area because of their higher rents, mortgages, and property taxes, gentrification is a housing, economic, and health issue that affects a community's history and culture and reduces social capital. It often shifts a neighborhood's character, for example, racial ethnic composition and household income, by adding new stores and resources in the previously run-down neighborhoods. So a further list of negative things about gentrification is there's displacement through rent and price increases, loss of affordable housing, commercial and industrial displacement, unsustainable property prices, displacement and housing demand pressures on surrounding poor areas, community resentment and conflict, homelessness, secondary psychological cost of displacement, increased cost and charges to local services, loss of social diversity, and from socially disparate to rich ghetto, and under occupancy and population loss to the gentrified area. These came from Loretta Lees, Tom Slater, and Elvin Wiley from the Gentrification Reader from 2008. Now, I also found on Britannica Academic a profile of the city of Chicago that goes deep into the gentrification actions or concept that's going on there. And let me read you the description here. The most recent destabilizing factor in some areas of the city has been gentrification. Conveniently located old houses and apartments have lured enough financing to transform once abandoned districts into communities of upscale housing units. Since the last decades of the 20th century, thousands of new residents have moved into the light manufacturing belt surrounding the Loop, where immigrant workers once carried their lunch pails to work in factories. These young urban professionals clutch briefcases and talk on their cell phones as they walk to work in downtown office towers. Similar developments are transforming the housing and manufacturing districts along several rapid transit, popularly the L for elevated, lines, and in parts of the traditionally African-American communities along the shore of the lake. Boutiques and coffee houses have displaced small grocers and other marginal merchants, while the process has saved neighborhoods in one sense and brought back large numbers of affluent residents in the city. It has also tended to increase property values and tax assessments to the point where longtime residents of modern, modest means are displaced. Indeed, many of the 1960s era public housing projects have now been raised, although some provisions have been made for housing the former tenants. So, to give you more of an example, that's out of Chicago, but the reason it means so much to me here in Louisville is that there's a area of town called Germantown. It's a used to be an enclave for German Catholics. It's where my father's family were born, so where I spent a lot of my time during my youth, in my teenage years, once I got a car. And what they're doing now is that there is an area of town that borders on Germantown. It's called the Highlands. Now, the Highlands is the trendy, hipster, yuppie area of town. And it's become so crowded, there's no housing there, there's so many businesses, traffic is terrible. So what they're doing is expanding into Germantown. So what they're doing is they're building new lofts in Germantown, they're bringing in these fancy bars, and the property values are going up extremely high. So what's going to happen is that the people are not going to be able to afford those property taxes. They're not going to be able to afford to go shop at Whole Foods that's going to be put in there instead of their old local market, and they'll be forced to move out. And the reason that, you know, government kind of lets this happen is that the higher-end residents that come into a town that's been gentrified, more taxes are raised. And, of course, urban economy is all about raising urban taxes. Now, what I'd like to share with you is an article that I found in The Guardian from September 25th. The Guardian is a great leftist, working class newspaper from Britain that I highly recommend. And the article is called Me Too's Hidden Activist? Working Class Women. And the subtitle is Janitors and Fast Food Workers, Not Celebrities, Are Ground Zero for the Me Too Movement. Time to Shift the Focus to Them. It's by author Alyssa Quart. And like I said, it's from September 25th, 2018. Last Tuesday, McDonald's workers in 10 U.S. cities walked off the job to protest against pervasive sexual harassment. A week earlier, female janitors in California marched 100 miles from San Francisco to the state capitol in Sacramento to support anti-harassment legislation. The Janitors Union, SEIU, in partnership with the East L.A. Women's Center, has been quietly training women in self-defense and promoting peer-to-peer anti-harassment workshops and an assault crisis hotline. In Monday's mass walkout of protesters around the nation in support of Christine Blasey Ford, the California professor who has accused the Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is now Justice Brett Kavanaugh, of attempting to sexually assault her when they were high school students, was another stunning step. These efforts represent an element of the Me Too movement seen in Her Too Little. The protests now crowd ordinary women, rather than that of celebrity Me Too advocates, which is often evinced at award ceremonies or on Twitter. Yet a year after Me Too's popularization by several famous actors, and 12 years after the phrase was coined by activist Tarana Burke, We have been inundated by the stories of celebrity villains and celebrity survivors, like Les Moonves' horrifying acts as CBS's head predator to the public fight between Me Too starlets Rose McGowan and Asia Argento, to the self-pitying, not really apologetic, alleged harassers, like the former radio host John Hockenberry and Jean Gomeshi, whose accounts were published this month in Harper's and the New York Review of Books. I hope I got that right, Jean Gomeshi. But there comes a point when bold-faced names must exit stage right. Me Too must be a movement for all, for ordinary women as well as for the renowned among us. And to do that, we should clearly classify Me Too both as what it is and what it should be, a labor movement. If we don't turn Me Too over to female fast food workers, janitors, farm workers, cashiers and waitresses, as well as professors and librarians, we will continue to read and hear about celebrity villains. They are the other side of the coin from celebrity victims, after all. The sad drinking game, named the next man who will crawl out of the well-funded so-called exile to demand public sympathy, could go on and on. Exhibit A is Gomeshi, who writes tenderly about being an erstwhile celebrity who is now an outcast after he was accused by 24 women of brutal acts, including punching and choking them, hijacking the tale of his own alleged bad acts. In contrast, the bravery that poor and working class women like the McDonald's workers or even middle class women show in embracing this battle is rarely either dramatic or self-pitying. Yet their risks of getting fired, deported, or even physically harmed far outstrip those of either celebrity survivors or perpetrators. We should move our collective gaze to them. Let me say that again. We should move our collective gaze to them. We need to hear from people, not the actresses, not the people you are asking for autographs from, but those cleaning on the night shift who have been grappling with the issues for decades, says the SEIU United Service Workers West Secretary Treasurer Alejandra Velez. She represents invisible women, as she puts it. If Me Too's prominent women don't listen to others, this will be a huge loss of opportunity. As Bernice Young, author of In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers, told me, it's the specificity of what happens in individual jobs and professions that it is important. You must look at the problem industry by industry, workplace by workplace, detailing the specific ways female workers are abused in these venues. If you just think sexual harassment happens, you are thinking generically, and you might move on from the issue. It's critical to know that in each work contest, the casting couch in hotel rooms and hospitals, the female pastors of church, it plays out so differently, says Young. Even blue-collar harassers or assaulters' trajectories can be quite different from those of the most powerful assaulters. Working-class men aren't typically offered the opportunity to pen pathetic odes to their former glory in national publications, citing Lolita and Brahms, as Hockenberry did, to explain an apparent penchant for stalking. But the former type's relative anonymity also works in their favor. As Velez explains, these men often get proverbial slaps on their wrists, then are recycled into new jobs where they easily resume the same behavior. There are contemporary movements that are successful yet not dominated by the stories of celebrities. Look no further than the Black Lives Matter. In comparison, Leonardo DiCaprio types and their oil-guzzling jets have weighed down in another current movement, the environmental one. And in parentheses, to misquote Us Weekly, celebrities are not like you and me. A less fame-focused and more labor-oriented Me Too movement means incorporating not only poor and working-class women, but also women in middle-class occupations, like the female tech experts I interviewed 5 years in San Francisco, or many of the women now joining in the mass walkouts across the country in protest of Kavanaugh. At a technology conference infamous for sexual harassment, I witnessed a panel in which one of the male participants made frequent remarks while on stage about the large rack of one of the female panelists, and I was assured this was utterly typical. The Time's Up campaign seems to be trying to be inclusive of janitors and tech workers. The organization is aware that so many working women are not getting the same kind of attention as celebrities, Young says, and the National Domestic Workers Alliance has pushed to expand federal sexual harassment protections for all workers, closing every loophole. In addition, celebrities can, of course, be helpful to working women. Celebrity advocates bring a media and donor-friendly glow to fundraising for women's advocacy projects, and there is plenty of it to do. Women must begin to recognize how social stratification enables sexism and united, excuse me, how social stratification enables sexism and unites across classes to fight it as they are doing this week. If we don't figure out how to move past these identities, excuse me, these headlines and celebrity voices, how do we find solutions? Velez asked. People can be incredibly dismissive of the women who flip their burgers at McDonald's or clean the bathrooms of the boutique hotels and classy offices or even those shoving their kids' books. Yet listening to these women and their experience in protest, as the latest activism is showing, is the only way that Me Too movement will become a real movement, she argues. You don't need your sympathy, she adds. We need you to learn from us. All right, that was a great article from The Guardian from September 25th, 2018, by Alyssa Corp. Now, as a second piece of content for this episode, I'd like to read you another article from The Guardian, this one by Justin Quarry from the 13th of November, 2018, a lot more recent. It's an editorial called Why Coming Out as Working Class Was Harder Than Coming Out as Gay. Subtitle, I've Left the Closet Twice, as a gay man and as an academic from a working class background. The second was at least as hard. This is a great article that I can really identify with and testify to the truth of. All right, it begins, recently a colleague asked me what it was like growing up gay in Arkansas. Even I was surprised to find I didn't have an answer. After all, I should be an expert on that subject, and indeed, a couple of horror stories she no doubt expected to hear are true. However, as an adolescent, my sexual orientation, dormant as I kept it, wasn't the reason I felt queer. Right after I hit puberty, my mother and I moved to university town from a small farm community to escape the aftermath of my parents' divorce, and in the years that followed, she had to work too many hours and too many jobs for too little money to make ends meet. Periodically, she entered a depression, and I, in an attempt to prevent it, strove to be perfect. But my efforts to stop my mother's depression failed. As consolation, my professional earned me a subsidized spot in an elite university. This rendered my queerness an even starker contrast, since I was now among a student body, primarily from the top 20% of wealthiest families in the country. Though I developed many deep friendships at college, the fact of the matter was that I had a set of concerns quite different from those of nearly all my peers. They worried about flawless GPAs and gradations of the Greek system and whether or not their parents would bankroll tropical breaks. I worried about my mom's financial and emotional survival and how I was going to get to and from Arkansas and whether or not I could find an internship that would simply pay. It wasn't until later that I would worry about the balance and exorbitant interest rate of the credit card I had just gotten. Because for now, it was a relief to be able to buy dinner off campus or a shirt on clearance without having to do mental math to make certain I could afford it. To further complicate my situation, being the first person in my family to eventually finish college and one of the only few of us to leave Arkansas, I had now transformed myself into an alien among even my own people. For years, there were these more urgent obstacles of class to navigate before I could afford the luxury of parsing my sexuality. Now that I am a writer, now that I'm a professor, now that I'm 37 and still happily single, the fact that I'm gay is one of the least queer things about me. Because I believe in the importance of representation of minorities in the classroom, and because one sexual orientation typically isn't apparent, as a senior lecturer now at Vanderbilt University, the same institution I attended as an undergraduate, I often wonder if I should come out to my students at the beginning of each semester. I envy my LGBT colleagues who are married or otherwise partnered, thus set to reveal this aspect of their identities organically. For example, by simply mentioning what they did over the break and with whom. My own necessarily unprompted coming out as a single man probably would land me with all the awkwardness of a revelatory sit-down with mom and dad, which I never had with my parents. Recently, though, I realized the same need for representation in the classroom of first-generation college students. Representation of those of us from the working class. A year ago, in conjunction with the university's Office for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, I went with a contingent of Vanderbilt's faculty members, administrators, and the president of the student body, all of his first-generation college students, to discuss how the university might better serve its own first-generation students, who across the country have higher rates of stress and depression and lower rates of retention than their peers. What I was most surprised to learn at that meeting was that nearly everyone present reported that their working class status had had a greater impact on their experience as undergraduates, for some of them on their entire lives than did any other aspect of their identity, including race, gender, and sexual orientation. How best then for those of us who've risen from poverty to positions of power and influence, positions of financial stability, to help our younger counterparts, those who are struggling to rise themselves? We should make ourselves seen and heard. We should stand before low-income students as concrete examples of where they might go and whom they might become and what they might be. We should come out to them as working class. I only wish I had started making such bold declarations sooner. If I had, I would have learned in college that I wasn't alone, that there were other students like me with my particular concerns, more of them than I imagined. It wasn't until I started writing about my life that I realized there has been some working class backgrounds, even among my friends, but much in the same way as it was when I was Clay, was a closeted teen, the latent fear of being perceived as outside the norm, of never being the best simply because of who I am and will never be able to stop being, prevented me from seeing and speaking this truth. It prevented me from speaking it even to myself. When I come out to my students and colleagues as hope from this working class, colleagues as from the working class, I want to expand the idea of who or what a professor is. And I especially hope to give upwardly mobile students, those incarnations of my younger self, the example and language to find one another, to see one another, to be known to themselves. Today I can't help imagining, what if there had been someone at my mother's tiny rural high school where there was no college counselor, no one to expose the children of sharecroppers to options after graduation beyond working on a farm or in a factory? What if there had been someone like me to tell my mother she reminded me of me? To ask her, have you thought about college? Don't worry, I'd say, you're good enough. Don't worry, there's financial aid. Don't worry, I'd reassure her, you'll belong. Very powerful piece from Justin Quarry, who's a senior lecturer and program coordinator for undergraduate creative writing at Vanderbilt University. This essay was originally published in the Chronicles of Higher Education and reprinted with permission in The Guardian. Powerful, powerful piece. So in closing to this episode too, I'd just like to say thanks for listening. I look forward to getting some emails and some voice messages from listeners. Please subscribe. I'm very excited about this opportunity, and I don't want to get anybody's hopes up. I know it's a little much, but I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, but I think I'm going to have a good interview for next week's podcast, a good interview with some union representatives. But as for now, have a great week, enjoy Thanksgiving, and have a great day. Thank you. Thank you.